Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. On the program with us this week is my old friend and colleague, Dr. Gerald Benjamin, SUNY Distinguished Professor of Political Science, Associate Vice President for Regional Engagement, and Director of the Benjamin Center at SUNY New Paltz since 2008. Welcome, Jerry Benjamin, and I have to say it's extraordinary when they name something after you before you're dead.
Well, that remains to be seen whether I've met that condition.
That's funny. So, Jerry Benjamin, we're here to talk about something very dear to your heart, the Constitutional Convention, and whether New York voters should vote for one or against one. For the sake of just having fun, I'll take the con, you take the pro, and we'll see what we can come up with. Should there be a Constitutional Convention?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we want to restore home rule, if we want to address the ethics crisis in New York government, if we want to rebalance our institutions, which are way out of balance with a governor too powerful, if we want to give the Attorney General a constitutional basis for his desire to be a criminal prosecutor, if we want to straighten out the courts, which costs us an extra $500 million a year and nobody understands how they're organized, those are a few of the things we can do. If we want to make legislative districting fair, we need a constitutional convention. Certainly the legislature is never going to do any of those things.
The legislature, of course, has the power to do any of those things, as you suggest, but it's in their self-interest, we think, not to do it. They're not going to put...
The record demonstrates they haven't done it.
That's right. So, Jerry Benjamin, I guess the question then is, what is going to make this constitutional convention work? Now, you have a habit of interrupting me, but in the middle of a sentence, so I just want to be sure I can get this whole sentence out before you jump down my throat. Nevertheless, you know, the same people who control the nominating process for state and local offices are also the guys who are going to get their buddies, their cousin Louis, elected to this thing or run themselves. How do we know that's not going to happen?
Well, sorry I interrupt you, and I certainly won't do it again.
No, don't do that again, yeah.
Because I pride myself on my manners.
That's funny. Go ahead.
Let me respond by saying there is some chance or no chance. So the convention offers us some chance for reform. The absence of a convention offers us no chance. Now, the nominating process, as you know, I have encouraged reform of the structure of the nominating process and the election law, both for this and for other reasons, some of which is constitutional, some not, and the legislature has not changed the process. So we're in a catch-22 situation. The legislature says, well, the process is no good. You're going to elect us, and we're going to do nothing, which is itself laughable. And then they say, and since the process is no good, don't call the convention. Don't bypass us. Don't reform your government. Let us veto the only way you can actually achieve reform. So we take a process that's designed to bypass those folks, and we let them veto our use of that process. Now, who will be elected? Well, the people of New York will determine who will be elected. And I'll tell you what, if we call a convention, the first thing that's going to happen is that we're going to have a review of the process for nominating an election, because we have a 19th century process, and we're now in the 21st century, and there are some rules and standards for elections, federal, for example, that did not exist in the 19th century. So we will have a thorough review before those elections occur.
Well, now, there will be people who think that that's somewhat naive. Far be it from me, your intellectual junior, to say that you're naive. But what in the world makes you think that these people who know that their continuance in office, their power, is going to be based on who gets elected to that convention, that they won't pull the strings to get the same old symbols?
Pardon me, I almost interrupted.
Yeah. You did. Go ahead.
Luckily, you remembered President Reagan's line.
Which was?
There you go again.
Right.
Famous line from the debates.
Thank you.
But we're not on that topic now.
No.
The fact of the matter is that the election for delegates is going to occur in 2018. The same year that the election for the legislature occurs. So the members who want to run for both offices are going to be vulnerable to criticism for running for both offices. They're going to have to take on that liability. And I think that's going to be a factor.
Well.
Additionally, the nominating process will be open to partisan primaries. And I, for one, if not nominated for a delegate and there's a convention, will run in a primary against whoever else seeks to be nominated. We know that in 1967, the record's been massively misrepresented. 16 sitting members were elected to the convention. Now, some sitting legislators took charge of the leadership of the convention, and the legislative rules were adopted by the convention. Those are two things that I think should not have happened, and I would hope and expect and work toward them not happening again. But the idea that the legislature dominated the 67 convention is just incorrect, an incorrect read of history. It's simply not correct.
Okay, let's not argue that, but let's assume for a second that self-interest always rules. I think, by the way, it's a false premise that they're going to run themselves. They probably won't run, but they'll get their cousin Louis, as I said before, to run, or they get somebody that they know to run. And yes, Jerry Benjamin will win in Ulster County, but you're a rare bird. You're well thought of. You were the majority leader of the county legislature. You're incredibly well respected. This doesn't exist in the rest of the state, does it?
Well, it certainly does. I'm involved in a group now. There's over 100 members. Many of them will run from all across the state. They're not incumbent politicians. We must admit and understand that people who are interested in politics will run. But we also have to recognize that since the presidential election, massive new mobilizations have occurred across the state. I've been appearing before groups that didn't exist before the Sanders candidacy. Mm-hmm. And they're all mobilized and all interested in running. And these are non-incumbent jobs. Nobody's holding the jobs now. So I think that we can't predict. By the way, the convention of 67 produced a pretty good constitution that lost at the polls because of the way it was offered to the public. But
Well, that's easy for you to.
So the outcome of the institution that everybody's criticizing was not negative at all. It was quite positive.
Well, that's easy for you to say. It lost because of this or because of that, but it did lose.
But it is also, forgive me, Alan, but it's also easy to predict negative outcomes on the same basis as the predictions I'm making. So we have to be a little careful about predictions.
That's political science talk. Okay, I want to ask you some of the things that you said going into this conversation. You raise certain things that you'd like to see done in a constitutional convention. One is home rule. Explain what that's all about.
Home rule is, there's an Article 9 of the New York State Constitution which tries to give a degree of autonomy to local government in their in what they can do and how they organize themselves. And this article has been undermined by Court of Appeals decisions that favor essentially produce state dominance in most areas, not all areas, over local government. So the taxi cab regulation across the state is with the New York State Legislature. The size of the sugar drink that you can sell in New York City is subject to action of the New York State Legislature. The legislature is entirely too often into local matters, so we have to reconsider how we define the distinctions between what the legislature and the state should do and what the locality should do.
So you want to give more power to the localities and take some of it away from the state. Is that the bottom line on this?
Well, I want the localities to be able to do local things and the state to do state things. The state shouldn't be in the business of governing localities. New York City government is essentially a fight between New York politicians elected to go to Albany and New York politicians elected to go to City Hall about who should run New York City. That's not the way it should be.
Yeah. But the devil, of course, Jerry, is in the details. In other words, where do you draw those lines so that there's some consistency in the state, right?
Well, yeah, and I've set out some ideas, and as others have, in various places where I've written about this. But we have to take out the language from the Constitution that's led to these interpretations and replace it with language that would more likely produce a degree of local autonomy on local matters. Not on all matters, on matters that are local. And it's within our capacity to do that.
One of the things that you and I and all political scientists talk about is the law that says that the city is a creature of the state.
Right.
Do you want to change that?
Well, it's not a law. It's a theory. There are two dominant theories about local government and the relationship with state government across the country.
I had quotes around the word law. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't mean that to be critical.
You didn't mean to take a cheap shot, did you? No.
No, I did not. I genuinely did not. Sometimes I do, but that time I didn't. And I would say that Dillon's rule, which that's called Dillon's rule. Dillon's rule has been essentially the entire home rule movement has been designed to try to undo or limit Dillon's rule, and we've been insufficiently successful at doing that. So yes, I do think we need to continue to work at modifying and constraining Dillon's rule.
One of the other things that you brought up in the very beginning of the show was that you want to see ethics reform in the legislature. How do you want to do that?
Well, I think we should have an ethics institution, an ethics entity embedded in the Constitution with real powers, and with the appointment to this board not controlled by incumbents and its actions not controlled by minorities from one or the other house of the legislature.
Easy for you to say. How would you do it? I mean, you know, right now governors appoint heads of these commissions, and it turns out to be a lot of nothing. Legislators get an appointment or two. Leaders get an appointment or two, and then we're surprised when nothing happens. How do you do it?
We achieve a degree of autonomy in the judiciary by longer terms. So once people are appointed, they can act autonomously, or they because they have longer terms, and they're not worried about people interfering with their with their autonomy or their action. Second, we can empower them substantially in the Constitution, not in statute. So it's harder to get at their powers. You're right. We have to think about how to arrange the appointing authorities. I would not elect these people. They would be appointed. So I'd have to think about the appointing authorities.
Got any ideas?
And the conditions under which, we might specify certain qualifications or conditions that a person would have to meet before they could be appointed at all, constraining the pool of appointees. But I have to think that through a little more. It's a fair criticism.
Okay, so the two things that, you know, I care about a great deal, and we've talked about this many times, Jerry, are initiative and referendum, which I am a great believer in, even though a lot of my fellow political scientists don't like it. And the other area, you know, of course, is something that is very popular in New York City, but not New York State, which is term limits. I don't hear the people who are pushing the Constitutional Convention, you, Hank DeLay, other people, yelling about this as a way to get people to vote for the convention.
Right. Well, first of all, let's take term limits. If we had fair and competitive elections, we wouldn't need term limits. But we don't have fair and competitive elections because the conditions under which legislators and statewide officials are elected are defined by them to their own advantage. So I am for term limitation. Now, you have to think about the detail of that, you know, how many terms and how long term should be, and so on. But I am for term limitation. I've been for it for a long time. I've written about it over the years. So you and I agree about that. Regarding initiative and referendum, I don't think the places that have the initiative are better governed than the places that don't. California, for example, is I don't regard as a paragon of good government. It has the initiative and uses it a lot. But I will say this, that term limitation and any initiative and referendum will be vigorously debated and have a chance of adoption at a convention, depending on who becomes the delegates, as you have noted. And those ideas will have no chance of ever being adopted without a convention. No chance at all. Historically, the places that have adopted these ideas, well, certainly the places that have adopted term limitation, which is a modern idea, it dates to the 90s, have all done so, with one exception, by going around the legislature, not through the legislature. Now, regarding the constitutional change process, which is done by the initiative in some states, I'd be amenable to that to some degree. Not so much making laws, but making constitutional changes, so we can get away from this broad concern about the breadth of our constitutional change process, and we could focus on particular issues or matters. So regarding constitutional initiative, I'm convincible, not the statutory initiative.
Jerry Benjamin, how do you deal with the insidious role in a constitutional convention of money? I mean, let's face it, this is Alan speaking, not Jerry, but it's fee for service. You give a lot of money, you're Harvey Weinstein, you ask for something back, you're anybody, you want something in return for your money quite often. Maybe not always, but most of the time. That's why we have such a large lobbying community and everything else. So how do you deal with that in a constitutional convention?
Of course, we have the federal interpretation of the First Amendment equating money with speech, which I think is an unfortunate decision, but we're constrained at the state level about that. The whole question of money has come up on the convention question, the argument that so-called dark money will dominate the convention process. Meanwhile, the money that's dominating this process, and I've been very active in this, in advancing the convention idea across the state, the money that's dominating the process is union money. Now, unions have every right to spend their money, but they shouldn't say money's going to come in and compromise this process while they're spending the big money to defeat the process.
Yeah, but Jerry, two wrongs don't make a right.
Big money has several... But just to put parameters around it, big money has several origins. It's not just the so-called dark money or the conservative money.
Well, by the way, I didn't say... Now, Jerry, whoa.
No,
I didn't...
No.
It's my program. I didn't say that. You're the one who brought up the unions. All I said is, how are you going to deal in a new New York State Constitution with the role of money?
Well, we can take the New York City example, and we can put a voluntary public financing process in place that will be sufficiently well-funded that we will have candidates opting for it. And we can do that. That was done by statute in New York City, not by charter, but it was done quite precisely because we threatened to do it. I worked on that, and we threatened to do it in the charter. So we can provide some alternative to big money influence through constitutional change. Now, some people say, let me add something else. Some people say that I advocate for doing lots in the Constitution that's statutory and shouldn't be done in the Constitution. There are two answers to that. Lots of the things people want to defend in the Constitution would be regarded as statutory, including our commitment to Forever Wild, which I support, our commitment to a civil service system, which I support, and so on. And the second thing is some things have to be put beyond the reach of the legislature because they've demonstrated that they will not do them and they're desirable. So.
Jerry, we've dealt a little bit with ethics, although not to my satisfaction about how you're going to do it, and you couldn't really get around that appointing question. But I wonder what else you got in mind.
What else do I have in mind? Well, look at the budget process. Look at the so-called big ugly that we now have, with all substantive matters being driven into the budget and everybody wanting their substantive goal in the budget. I think that the governor is entirely too powerful in budgeting, and I think the legislature, we ought to rebalance this. And interestingly, the legislature stands to gain, even though all their leaders are against opening up negative about a convention.
Well,
so
what makes you think, Jerry Benjamin, that the legislature deserves to have more power vis-a-vis the governor? I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of this particular governor or other governors, but I have to tell you, the legislature, you know, people are being carted off to the who's gal. Why would you want to give them more power?
Well, corruption is anathema. Most members are not corrupt. We can't tar every member. That's the first point.
Well, but you have the leaders. You have the leaders of both houses gone. You have Sheldon Silver gone. You have Dean Skelos gone.
That's why we need to entrench stronger ethics provisions outside their reach. But the second, but institutionally, the legislature is the locus of representative democracy, and the spending power in American democracy should be and is with the legislature, not with the governor. No single person should decide what we spend our money on that we raise by taxation. It's a representative system, and it doesn't operate properly. It needs to be reformed, but it's still, we must remember that we are not a quasi-dictatorship.
What else you got?
Judicial reform. We have the least well-organized judiciary in the country. One study done in 2007by a commission appointed to look into it said that simplification and reorganization of the judiciary would save litigants and the government $500 million a year. That was in 2007, 10 years ago. We've known what we need to do for years and years. There's been study after study, but nothing happens because the entrenched political powers want to keep the judiciary just the way it is and control appointments to judicial office, or elections, I should say, elections to judicial office. So we need to address judicial reform. And the leaders of the judiciary know this. They know this, but they can't break the logjam on this question. So that's fundamentally important and given insufficient attention in the debate we've been engaged in so far.
So it really comes down, right, to optimism versus pessimism. You know, I want to believe you. I really do, Jerry. You're a good friend. You're the senior political scientist on state government in the state and probably the country. And I want to believe you. It's just that I'm having a hard time getting there.
Well, you know, you're right. And you're quite right about whether it's optimism or pessimism. But there's another dimension. Do you take a chance on and try to get change by creating, by going around the sclerotic institutions that we have, where you take no chance and say, you know, I'm chronically ill, I have to live with it, so I'm going to go on and live with it? Do you try to repair the situation or not? Even though you have an imperfect process, an imperfect and fear negative outcomes and been disappointed a lot of times. And my answer is you take a chance for change, because what you've got is unacceptable. And the risks are, Alan, I have to say that the risks have been overblown in a lot of specific ways that we haven't talked about. And there's been a lot of campaigning based on fear. You're going to lose something important to you if you allow this to happen. Sometimes the fear, the driving people on the basis of fear is not a positive way to govern. All the time, it's not a positive
way. Well, it's true. And you're referring, of course, to the fact that the state unions are saying you'll lose your pensions, your right to an absolute constitutional guaranteed pension, if you vote for this thing, right?
Well, yes. And that's, of course, not true, because the contract clause of the U.S. Constitution prevents the states from abrogating or interfering with contractual obligations, and the pensions are contractual obligations. So nobody's going to lose their pension who holds one now, and nobody's going to lose their pension who currently works for government and is in a pension system. Now, regarding pension change, the state has changed pensions prospectively over and over. You'll just ask state employees who are in different pension tiers. So that's prospective. But people, nobody's going to lose what they have now, and a lot of people are fearful that they are. I've been debating all around Hudson Valley, New York City, and northward and so on, and that's what people come out and worry about, and they've been misled.
So we are out of time. Our guest has been SUNY Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Associate Vice President, Regional Engagement Director at the Benjamin Center, Dr. Gerald Benjamin. Jerry, it's always wonderful to have you. You've been a lifelong friend, and I depend on you to read it out. Sometimes we don't always agree. Sometimes I don't even know if I agree with you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, because you are certainly among the most knowledgeable people in the state on this subject. So it's
I'm surprised by that. Anyway, it's wonderful to talk to you, Jerry, and you know that you're always welcome here on the air. We love to have you. Thanks so much.
Great to be here, Alan. Thank you for the opportunity.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.